Hello and welcome to another episode of the Selfish Podcast. Today we have Mick Marshall, and I'm really excited to hear his story and journey. He's been a professional runner for many years, and I know a little about him, so I know the story is going to be very interesting and very in-depth. But first, Mick, welcome. Can you just share with myself and the audience, where in the world are you and what time of day is it for you?
G'day, Luke. No worries at all. I'm in a place called Ballarat, which is in Victoria, in Australia, and we're right down the south. So it's the third day of winter here, mate, and it is bloody freezing. So very, very cold. Yeah.
What time of day is it for you?
The time is 5 o'clock, 5 p.m.
Yeah, because it's such a different time, because it's 9 a.m. in the morning here for me, and it's the beginning, it's hitting summer now, so it's getting really hot here in Spain. So it's amazing.
Yeah.
And it's in such opposite places at the moment. So
yeah.
Am I right,
I'm jealous you're just talking about it.
Yeah, Victoria, is it southwest?
Yeah, southeast.
Southeast.
Yeah, southeast. It's not, we're about 1 hour from Melbourne. That's the capital city of the state. So yeah.
Okay, nice. Yeah, I know a little about Australia, and again, it's one of them places. It's really interesting because it's English speaking, but we got so little influence over in the UK from any, like, we don't have any of your, say, pop stars or singers or TV shows. Like, the most we had is a show called, when I was younger, a show called Neighbours and Crocodile Dundee, and that's the only two things I can really. You know, there's a couple of actors, Hollywood actors, but they're really Hollywood actors. You know, they're not Australian. They've come from Australia.
Yeah, that's right. The one you'd know the most, I reckon, in the UK, she was a superstar, was Kylie Minogue.
Yeah. So it's a fascinating place. I was always fascinated with it since I was a child. Like, just looks so interesting and diverse there. And New Zealand as well has always fascinated me for some reason.
Yeah, look, I feel very blessed to be here in this country, or born into this country, because we do have everything on the, you know, on our big island, I suppose. There's all the dynamics of environment are here, and you know, we've got some pretty special animals as well, and yeah, there's a lot of unique things about the place. So
yeah,
and it's a big country. Yeah.
Well, I'm really interested in how you got into running, and I know you've been around the world running, but first I love with my guests to get to know them more personally, so I want to hear about your childhood. Can you paint me a picture of what life was like, say, pre 10 years old?
Yeah, terrific. Fairly simple family. My mum and dad, my father's an electrician, worked hard all his life. Mum come off a farm, and when I was 4 years old, I purchased a 3-acre property that backs onto the Canadian forest, or the Canadian bush here near a running creek. So I was always very, very close to nature, and very, very close to the water and all the elements. And that has been my place since I was 4 years old. And mum and dad have just celebrated 52 years there. They're still there. So nice. It's a place I get to call home, and I feel very blessed to be able to go and visit that place still. And that's where, I guess, you know, growing up, we never had a TV. We never had running water. We bathed in a copper back in the, I'm probably showing my age here, Luke. But, and you know, an outside toilet, animals everywhere. And it was a very simple life, but every time I used to get into trouble, I used to run down the back, and that was our backyard. We used to play down the back and go swimming in the creek and fishing, and we have a big hill up the back, you know, that's all treed, and I'd run up and down that. And I never thought of it so much as training. I just used to do it. We used to love, you know, we'd make cubby huts in the bush and all that sort of stuff. And it was back in the days where your mum used to say, I don't want to see you till the sun comes down, you know, and so it was a good life, and we never really required the TV and all that sort of stuff. So, we just lived simply, and in school we used to ride our bikes to school, and and ride home. And it was a good little community, actually, Luke. And, yeah, feel very lucky to have been around that.
Yeah, it sounds beautiful. Well, so how was school? Did you like school? And how far did you have to, was you remote? How far did you have to travel to get to school?
Yeah, well, look, school was about, the primary school I went to was only a small one. It wasn't huge. Probably you would say I was a fairly introverted kid. I had two brothers, and we sort of kept to ourselves. Mum and Dad were quiet people, and we just stayed on our land, and we never ventured too far. So school was always challenging for me, Luke, a little bit. I didn't find it difficult to make friends, but I just found it difficult to branch out, I guess. So being a fairly quiet sort of fella, and I used to get embarrassed fairly easily. And then when I approached secondary school, I figured school definitely wasn't for me. Hmm. It wasn't my thing. I always enjoyed sport, though. Sport was something that always saved me. I always fell into playing sport. I was never terrific at it, but I always gave it my best shot because I just, there was nothing else I enjoyed about school, to be honest. So,
okay. Yeah, nice. Yeah. Do you remember what your earliest, and I'll just let you know in case the audience can hear as well, there's a load of, big herd of sheep, or flock of sheep, should I say, that's passing right near me with their bells ringing. So if anyone can hear that noise, that's what that is. Yeah. Mm-hmm. With your earlier life, like, do you remember your first like ambition or dream or something you wanted to sort of become when you was older?
Yeah, I do. I remember being at secondary school and saying to my woodwork teacher, school's not, you know, I just don't like school. What can I do? And the woodwork teacher said, you need to go and get an apprenticeship. You'll need to go and get a job. And I remember going home one day and I spoke to my father and I said, Dad, I don't know what to do. I'm really struggling at school and I find it really difficult. And he said to me, well, you better go get a job, get a trade. And I asked him, what do you reckon? And he was an electrician. And so I just immediately went down that path. So I did. I had a goal to be an electrician. And that came to fruition. I left home at 15 years of age and went down to Melbourne, which is our capital city in the state. I don't know, there's about 3 million people live in Melbourne, I guess, now. I became a railway electrician, which was, being a really shy country boy and going down to Melbourne and living in boarding houses, it was a real eye-opener. So I learned very quickly how to not only survive but thrive in an environment around people because I was forced to. I never got, and there's a funny old thing, isn't there, you know, sometimes if you don't get the choice that's made for you is a good one. So I never had a choice. I could have quit after 3 months, but I didn't. I persevered, and I'm very thankful that I did because it evolved into a lot of other things. So, and I guess that was the start of a path to finding or building my resilience up, you know, through your adversities, because it was where I'd done my apprenticeship, and it was all sorts of different ethnic groups and people and ways, and I seemed to be able to adapt very well. That's one thing that I figured out that I could do, was adapt to different circumstances, after completing my apprenticeship, I still had the bug to do lots of sporty stuff, and I guess I played team sport until I was about 39, and then I broke my wrist really, really badly playing AFL football, and that sent me on a different track. So I always thought I wanted to run a marathon, so then I set my goals at running a marathon, and then that's what escalated my running journey, I guess, Luke, and then I had some really bold ambitions.
So you started running at 39, did you say?
Yeah, I was a late bloomer, very much so. I wanted to run a marathon and I'd done all the rookie mistakes of just diving in and entering and tried to run one and I broke down. And then at age 42 was a time where I'd done the some training and thought, okay, well, I'm going to have a real crack at it now. And I did. I ran the Melbourne Marathon. It was, the date was the 10th of the 10th of the 10th, so that was pretty uncanny. And I ran my first running event at age 42, yes.
What gave you the sort of inspiration? What turned your sight towards running? Was it someone that recommended it? You watched something or?
Yeah, well, I always have been interested in sport. And as I said, I didn't really like running that much, but I fell into it because there was nothing else I could do. I really loved team sport. But the running thing sort of got me to run a marathon. I thought I'd do that and that'd be it. But I ran it, and I ran it in a very good time for my age. And people started asking me, you know, and saying, oh, you should do some more. And I had an accidental meeting with another lady. Her name's Tash Fraser. She's an ultra legend, an ultra running legend. She's world class. She represented Australia and everything. And I bumped into her one day, and she said, you should try and run a little bit further. And I thought, are you crazy? And anyway, you know, I don't mind a challenge. So I did. And I entered a 50-kilometer race. And lo and behold, cut a long story short, the further I actually ran, the better I got, and the better I got at it. I seemed to be able to sustain a level pace, and I had the correct mindset through growing up, and you know, naturally running through the bush and all those types of things, and sort of always wanting to peek over the fence, Luke. I've never been one that, you know, would say no to a challenge. I'm fairly impulsive like that, and that, yes, it can get you into trouble, that's for sure. But I really enjoyed the challenge of running, I guess. And I also, what I enjoyed, it took me back to my childhood a bit, because I enjoyed the solitude of it.
Yeah.
Just being on my own, and it's my thing, and doing that. And, yeah, and that branched into a few other events, and I'd done quite well. And then an event called the Big Red Run came up, which was a desert race in Herdsville in Australia here. And it was a 250-kilometre event over 5 days. And it's first 4 days a marathon. So you run a marathon, 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 marathon. And then on the last day, they throw in 84 kilometres just for good measure. And I actually I ran that, and it was the first one I ever did, and I won it, and I broke the course record. And then I thought, wow, something in this for me, because I absolutely loved it. I loved the solitude, I loved the camaraderie, and I loved that it wasn't all about winning in the ultra game. It's about just completing or finishing. And if you get to the start line in some of these events, you're already a winner. You know, and the experiences of running around the world and things like that with this ultra game has been fascinating for me. It fascinates me, the people. They're not like, you know, there's no edge to them. They're very non-ego type people, because the winning isn't the thing. It's the actual doing. You know, it's the journey, you know, one step in front of the other, one foot in front of the other, and all those types of little mantras that you build. And they're a fascinating community too. So, you know, anyone that's willing to, you know, put their boots on and run 100 kilometres or so through some of the world's harshest environments, and they come from all walks of life, and they're all types of builds too. Some people call us crazy, but sometimes I wonder who the crazy ones are, Luke.
Yeah. So what age was you when you done that 250 kilometres? That's some distance to be running. How old were you then?
Yeah, I was 47.
Okay, so sort of 5 years from your first proper race, and you was got yourself up to standard. That's incredible. And congratulations on just the effort and the ability to do so.
Yeah. And then when you surprise yourself a little bit, Luke, it's funny, isn't it, when you surprise yourself a little bit, how much confidence you gain and how much traction your body actually starts to get and want to do more once you have that little. And it's not about just about the success. It's just finding something that you're good at, and or most of all, that you enjoy. And everyone says, you know, if you do what you love, you'll never work a day in your life. And I actually found that with my running, and that was something that I was really passionate about. I became a running coach, and I worked with disengaged kids at a place called Berry Street here, which are kids that have been brought up in very poor environments with their family, and so I became a youth leader in that environment. I went and lived in an Indigenous community as a youth sport and rec coordinator for about 12 months in a place called Groote Island. It's the fourth largest island off Australia, and the Indigenous group there they're called Andiliakwins. They're probably the most original, I guess, Aboriginal culture left in this country. And I actually lived with them for 12 months. And again, that all came to fruition through my running. So through my running history, I got these gigs and jobs and got to explore a bit of the world. And it's been fascinating.
Oh, nice. So did that become your sort of actual career then? Was all around the sort of running? Did you, and the electrician sort of stuff all stop?
Yeah. Well, it didn't stop, Luke. It just became an add-on. Like the electrician part, like when I lived at, you know, on Groote Island, for example, like they had, you know, lots of power outages and shortages and things like that. And they said, anyone know an electrician? And I was one. So I was able to help out when I could, because I still have my tickets and had my tickets. So, but yes, the running was the main game for me to help other people just get moving, I guess, Luke. It's you know, there's a lot to be said about your mental health and exercise. And I became an ambassador for that type of scenario. We've got these groups called Are You OK? I'm not quite sure if you've heard of those types of groups in the UK, but they're massive here in Australia, and they are a suicide prevention mob, and you know, and Berry Street as well, they sponsored me as well, and they're obviously big in mental health and youth, youth homelessness and things like that. And so it just, yeah, it manifested itself. It sort of kept finding me after a while, but it was something that I was very interested in, obviously mental health and suicide prevention, all these sort of things, because I've had my own journey with anxiety and depression, and it's a nasty rabbit hole, and we all have been there to some degree, but some more than others. And if we can help prevent that, or help people to see that we're all capable of getting out of those negative environments, I guess you could say, or negative states. I that's what I pretty much put my hand up to do. So, and I've loved the journey, and it hasn't been easy of late. So,
it's really, really fascinating, and it's admirable that you're putting your efforts and stuff to contribute to that area. And mental health has been a big part of my life. I don't know what you know of my journey, but I started a YouTube channel and then the podcast a year later. But my ambition with my YouTube channel was to bring awareness to health in general, but a big part was mental health, talking openly and freely about my issues with depression. I had depression for about 20 years, suicidal issues, insomnia, chronic fatigue. I had a lot of stress. I grew up with a mum who had severe schizophrenia. And I was sort of her carer from a child, and it caused me to question my life as at a very young age, about 7 years old. I think it was my first time I thought about suicide, and it was only once I got out of that, and it's something I sort of thought I had to manage before. It's something I lived with and managed, and a little bit of me thought, well, I'll get out one day when I fix all my problems and it's like I'll deal with all this stress, all this pain and suffering, because anyone would in this situation, and I'll get out of it one day. And when life got worse is when I actually got out of it. So like my message is to try and share the possibility of hope, as well as that there's an internal well-being despite external chaos. So if you can get to that place within, you're not then controlled by your external world as much as I was before. And that's what pushed me to start serving other people and putting content out. So it's really nice to connect with you on that and your journey there.
Yeah, that's terrific. That's that really resonates with me, Luke. That running nature for me, because meditation wasn't my bag. I find it difficult, but I don't now, and we'll probably get to that. But I used to run and run and run, because that's how the only way I could get rid of that so-called monkey mind. It was an outlet, and we all have to find something like that outlet, don't we, Luke? To actually get rid of the energy or whatever it is to make a switch or change. And I'm not quite sure if it's a change, but you hit the nail on the head just then. You said we learned to manage it.
Yeah, like it was a learn to manage it. And then at some point, I would say then it was like, wait a minute, I'm not the manager of my life. I'm the CEO of my life. You know? And I sort of got a promotion, I would say. And realized, okay.
That's right. But so I think sometimes when you try and manage it, you might correct me if you think I'm wrong here, but it gets worse.
Yeah, I found my issue was this is probably what a lot of managers from jobs I have had, this is what managers seem to do, is they live by expectations on how you should behave.
Yeah.
And you're sort of dictated to rather than supported and encouraged most of the time.
Yeah.
And that's how I was with myself.
That's right. And then you have to force issues, don't you?
And things can't always go perfectly the way you want. So when you live in that way, you're always going to find some way of being disappointed or unsatisfied or angry, because something will happen that will take that. And for me, I had my outlet when I was a youth was boxing. I joined a boxing club at about 11 years old, done that for 10-ish years. Never went competitive, although my coach really wanted me to. I was just there to let out stress and to do something different with my body. And I loved it.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and particularly boys and men, we do build up energy. It's just a natural way that we are. Like, we do have excess energy, and sometimes if we don't know how to manage that or handle it, and that causes all sorts of different things. So, it's interesting you said boxing, because I think exercise is a terribly undervalued mental health strategy, Luke. I really do.
Yeah. Well, I even remember when I was younger, like once I got into my sort of later teens, I was helping coach at the boxing club, and it was an amazing experience to help the younger kids and stuff, like just learn and put their energy into something. And you'd get all different kids that turned up for different reasons.
Oh, gotcha.
And it was like some that had been bullied, and that's why they've turned up, because they feel like they need to toughen themselves up. You know, and you see their self-confidence build, and they're literally see them change over a short amount of time in just the way they carry themselves.
That's right. And it doesn't take much, does it, to build that confidence or self-esteem, just a little bit of encouragement, or to just push them over the edge to try something that they believe that they can't.
Yeah, and just the consistency as well. The hardest thing is the ones that
just keep turning up. Yeah.
But for the most part, the group environment of having other people there, and then when they realize that they're supported there and it's not a competition between each other, and you're not enemies, that you're a team, even though
you're actually mates.
Yeah, boxing's an individual sport. What was great about where I boxed is it was above a youth center, was the boxing training center. But after boxing, we'd all go chill out. There was a couple of pool tables, there was a basketball.
Yeah, that's awesome.
So you
that just gave me tingles, mate. You just gave me tingles.
Yeah. And you could socialize afterwards as well. So it just built that bond.
Exactly.
And it was great for the kids.
And it's not all hard work and things like that. You get to chill out and relax. And it's really nice to be able to kick back once you've done something hard and difficult, or pushed yourself a little bit and you're a bit buggered. And then you just get to relax with some other people. I think that's an environment that's really nice too.
Yeah, definitely. And what I did notice was a lot of like other kids, like people in school that I would try and get and recommend to come in, or friends I'd meet and try. And their parents had a lot of hesitation. They're like, oh, my parents would never let me go. And I was like, why? And they're like, oh, they don't want me to get into violence. And I was like, The only reason I'm not violent, I think, is because I'm here. You know,
like, yeah, that's true. Yeah,
I was like, if I weren't here boxing, I would probably be getting into fights and trouble. And all
that's right, you'd be getting into fights anyway, or getting into trouble. Yeah,
I was like, that took me on a path of self discipline, and you know, I wanted to start watching weight. I watched when my friends went out drinking and doing things. I was like, no, I've got training tomorrow.
Yeah, wow.
So I don't want to slow down.
Yeah, and that's right. And that's the dynamic too, because once you put yourself on a course like that, or put yourself in a place like that, and you start to get motivated and create goals for yourself, you don't want to do the stuff that's going to hurt you so much, do you? So, you just want to see how much better you can go next time.
Yeah.
And to do that, you've got to eat well, and you start figuring stuff out, yeah.
But yeah, that sent me on a path. And what I realized later in my life is, because I went from boxing to personal training and working with bodybuilders and strongmen. And as I went down that path, I thought I was into health and fitness. And then I realized as my health got worse, I was like, okay, I've been on a path of fitness, but not appreciating the health side of aspects. And that was where...
That's right.
And then I lost the ability to be able to train, to exercise, to... do all the things that I was passionate about, and that gave me that freedom. And my partner got really sick, and I had to, that's how I ended up living how I'm living. I had to take her to another country for alternative care. I was told she would never walk again. She had a cardiac arrest, and she was 29 years old at the time, and she dropped dead for about 2 minutes, brought back with the electric pads. When she came back, she had like a memory loss, brain damage, and she couldn't walk properly, and she slowly lost the ability to use her right leg completely, and she was like wheelchair bound for a year on morphine and all sorts of medication, and constantly nearly going back into that cardiac arrest. And the doctors told me, they said, well, she's just lucky to have survived this one. Most people don't survive a sudden cardiac arrest. And they said,
yeah, wow, I feel like I want to meet her, Luke, because that's where my journey of my running journey took a big stop. I went to work one day. I said I was an electrician before, and 13 months ago, I 6th of April 2021, I'll never forget it, I went to work, and I work at a wind farm. So we was a service technician, so I climb wind towers, and that was what I used to do to keep fit and keep myself physically happy. It was an adventurous job climbing up and down those wind turbines, going out the top and having a look, and I loved it. I loved the gig. And I climbed to the top of one day, and I got my backpack caught on the brake pads at the top, just entering. I don't know, if you picture a wind turbine, you can see the little space shuttle on top of them. You know, that space shuttle bit, the little spot, like it looks like a space shuttle, where that's where the blades go. And I was just about to climb up into that, and I slipped, and my legs got caught in the ladder, and I fell down onto a platform, thankfully, about three metres below. But I was a bit of a mess. They had to lower me down from the outside, and 120 metres in the air, they had actually roped me down. And the people that sent me down were my workmates. They weren't professional ropers by any standards. And, you know, ambulance and medics and all those types of people couldn't get up there because they couldn't climb, because you couldn't get there. So we were a bit trapped, and to have your workmates drop you 120 metres on a rope was a very traumatic experience, more so for them. And but all these things happened on that day, and I actually, my left leg was snapped and my right foot was totally destroyed, and it's required a total foot reconstruction. So whatever the reason, I don't know why, but whatever the reason, the gods or the universe or the world decided to take running away from me. So I had to find another way, Luke, and it's been very challenging this last 13 months, but I've taken everything that I've learned in that arena and adapted it to this healing, because there's been a lot of major surgeries go on, and the surgeons, you know, can't quite believe my work ethic, and I'm actually picturing your partner right now. Mm. Work ethic, or the work that she's actually put in to just get herself into a better space, or to get herself healthy or well. So, and that's the journey I'm on right now, is just a it's not about running anymore. It's about me being here, being able to heal the best I can and be healthy. And who knows what that might bring in the future. But you become such a resilient bugger, I suppose, when you've done these things and you've challenged yourself time and time and time again, and you just don't give up, you know. And that's what they say resilience is, don't they, Luke? They say it's, you know, it's your ability to overcome adversities, and the more adversities that you overcome, the more resilient you become. So, you know, you become this really this person that, you know, believes that you can do anything, I guess. And I'd love to hear the finish of your partner's story, actually, in a wheelchair, and you know, where she's at.
Yeah, so with Danielle's story, what was fascinating is the diagnosis she was given at the beginning. This was in the end of 2015, if my memory serves me. Doctor said she got a 99% chance she won't survive 5 years. They said they always reoccur.
Wow.
And they said cause unknown. And they said she got 99% and basically told me I would be her carer, and there's nothing that can be done. And that just didn't satisfy me. And I was at the same time, my mum, like I said, I was caring for my mum a lot, and I always had to work as best I could, as sort of self-employed, doing different jobs because of being a carer for my mum and then being a carer for Danielle now. And it was like, for me, this was sort of around 2015. This course just was pushing me over the edge personally, and I was like really struggling. And I lost all my ability to do the things that I used to do that would keep me balanced, like going to the gym, exercising, to work.
Yeah.
I was going, just all I was doing is going between caring for Danielle to caring for my mum. And I think, again, with my mum's illness, it's really hard to tell exactly her motives and stuff behind, but she was attempting suicide every month for 7 months during this period. And I was taking her to the hospital to get her stomach pumped, coming back to then look after Danielle. And I think my mum was trying to take the pressure off me, to be honest. I think she was trying to take herself out of the equation because she knew.
Out of the picture. Yeah.
I think she knew deep down, she like how hard it was. I had a brother, but he was also ill at the time, but he was helping with my mum as best as possible. And that led me to my last ever suicidal episode. I got my mum back from hospital. I was headed to Danielle. I knew Danielle at this point had become suicidal in the stress. She was bedridden.
Yeah.
She couldn't think straight. She was highly medicated on the strongest forms of morphine.
Man, that's a lot of pressure. Yeah.
And she was told, like, she's just given you know, you've told your future's gone and you don't know when it's going to go, but it's definitely going, and you're not going to now even enjoy your last days. It's not like you can have a bucket list. You're stuck in a wheelchair. She felt sick in a car journey. I couldn't even take her to the park without her throwing up, you know. She couldn't do the motion, so she was indoors all the time. And then she felt like a burden, you know, because she's seeing me doing exactly what I was doing for my mum, for her. And it was like, and I couldn't take it at that point because of the stress of my future being unforeseen. And then something hit me within, and this was a bit like what you said with that resilience. I think it came from a lot of my adversities in life. Is I say it's like a fighting spirit. I was on the edge of jumping off a bridge into a motorway of traffic, and in the last moment, something hit me, and it was like, you know, I'm gonna find a way to love myself, to love life, to love to find joy. And I was like, despite. Even if Danielle dies, even if my mom dies, that's not going to control me anymore. And something switched within, and it wasn't instant, but it put me on a different track. And with that, I was just really thirsty to put all my effort into just see, like, they've said there's no option with her. This world of information out there, let me see what I can do. And having a background in personal training, I had a good grasp on anatomy and fitness. And so I knew, I knew the ability of physical practices, and the doctors hadn't told me anything for her to do with nutrition or physical training to rehabilitate her. That wasn't talked about at all. So I was like, if I can get her to that place where she can do this, I think she'll gain improvement. I'd previously worked with athletes who train in wheelchairs, you know, full-time bodybuilders that are completely paralyzed from the waist down.
Yeah.
So I was like, I've seen what's possible within a wheelchair with tremendous effort. So I was like, if I can just get her to a point where maybe she can build that effort into herself. But it was also what got me is trying to think why she went into a cardiac arrest. And a cardiac arrest different to a heart attack is that the heart continues to beat and it doesn't regulate itself. The beat just increases and gets faster and faster,
faster and faster,
until it just goes out. And the paramedic said her last reading was it hitting 400 when she went out, and he said he's seen nothing like it.
Wow.
So yes, and I was like, what controls the heart? What's telling it to beat fast, to beat slow? And I was like, it must be coming from the brain. And I was like, so how are the brain and the heart connected? And I was like, well, the nerves in the nerve going through your spinal cord to your heart. And that's some online looking for doctors that work in that area. And I found out about chiropractors, and I didn't know what one was. And I got two different opinions on them from when I looked at one, they're pseudoscience, one, they're miracle workers. And I was like, well, let's hope they're miracle workers in here, because that's what I need.
Yeah.
So I went down and was testing them out, and I put myself as the guinea pig first, because I didn't know whether they were like full of it or doing something real. So I was like, have you heard of something called jumper's knee? I don't know if you call it that in Australia or not.
No.
I the doctors diagnosed me with jumper's knee I had it for like 2 years, and it's like a severe pain in the just under your kneecap. It feels, if you bend it below a certain angle, it just feels like someone's just stuck a knife in your knee.
Wow.
Severely painful. And the doctors told me I'd overused my knee through training. And I was like, so I backed off my training for my legs. I changed my nutrition to like everything from my joints. For 2 years, yep. It made no difference. Nothing I could do seemed to make any difference. But I didn't want the surgery. Doctors said I could have surgery for the knee, and they said it may take away the pain, but your knee will deteriorate more. So I was like, well, I was like, I can deal with pain, but I don't want it to. I'll find a way to change it. One session at the chiropractor, I didn't tell him anything. He said, oh, you've got a problem in your lower back. And he goes, that's going down to your right knee. He goes, do you have a problem with your right knee? And I was like, yeah.
Yeah.
And he goes, what? And I told him the story, and he goes, do you train both your legs? I was like, yeah. And he goes, why aren't you worn out both your knees? And I was like, oh, good point. You know, I was like, I really pay attention to the symmetry and making sure that I'm evenly training my body. So yeah, I definitely do the same on both.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he goes, no, because it's actually coming from your back. And he goes, and when you're bending down, he goes, you're putting pressure on that area of your nerves in your lower back. And he goes, and that's triggering the knee. He goes, but nothing's wrong with your knee. And I was like, well, you say that, but let's see. And I had a session with him, went home, run upstairs. And I got to the top of the stairs and went, well, I just run upstairs. It's like, I haven't
done
it in 2 years. I started doing lunges just on the spot. Yeah. I was like, oh my God. And to this day, that was like 7 years ago. To this day, my knee has not had a problem. So I was like, right. I'm getting Danielle to these guys, and they give an x-ray of the back, and I'd done my own studies because I knew the position of spine is so important when you're weightlifting. It's a big part of my training with clients, is getting their posture correct, because you've got to have optimum connection to the muscles for them to function and for them to regenerate and recuperate. So I was like, I took Danielle there, they had an x-rayed, and I'd already done my own look. It's quite easy these days on Google. You can go on anatomy and central nervous system, and you can have a look at all the connections. It's a bit like
everything.
You can just see, like, okay, the heart connects to there. It's got two circuits that run it, and in the neck and in the upper thoracic spine. So I was like, okay. I went to there, and they x-rayed, and they go, oh my God, her neck was really bad. There was she had what's called a reverse curve. The natural curve of her neck was literally curving the other way in a rested position. And on the exact vertebrae where the heart comes out was completely twisted. And he said, like, I can't say, he goes, for legal reasons, that this is the cause. But he goes, do you not think that it's possible that this might be contributing to an issue? And I was like, that makes sense. She had several adjustments, and like instant, the only thing that I saw an instant change in her was that gave her a bit more movement in her legs. Saw her heart going from like 150, 200 and an instant drop as soon as they'd done the adjustment, where the heart was just beating super fast and it just went straight down to resting. So that sent us on a path to look into that, and sent me into a path of like, okay, there's something different going on here that's worth following through. And it's now been 7 years later, and not only is she alive, but she's walking, got her memory back, she's more conscious than she was, and she's completely medication free. And she has,
wow, what a great story.
Yeah,
what a great real story, you know.
Yeah.
So that's been my transition now, like 13 months of major surgeries and lots of bolts and bits and bobs going together, because I had to. I mean, you know, when you break bone, there's no magic, nerves or anything that can help that. You've got to get them realigned and straightened up. So I believe I'm on the comeback of something, and I'm very, very lucky to be here as well. So I count my blessings that that I actually hit the platform as I did, and I didn't go any further. And so I'm here for a reason, I believe, Luke. And with the transition of not being able to run, I've put my focus into how can I show other people now, or help other people to be able to see that they can do things. So in part of my rehabilitation, I've actually got a diploma of fitness as well. So, I was a PT for a while too. And I worked at a gym, and the instructor, after I had this accident, they see me come back from my first surgery and I'm crutching around the lake and got, walking again, and one crutch to walking and moon boot, then to jogging and to running. And then I go in for my second surgery and I do the process all again. And she came up to me and she said, "Look, Mick, I'm thinking about starting a running group. Would you like to coach it?" And I said to Tracy, "Are you taking the piss, because I can't run?" She said, "Well, you don't need to be able to run the coach, and you've got a lot of experience. So I'd like you to be able to teach people how to move, not so much run." So we started this thing called the Move Crew, and it's just gone nuts. It's just people of any walk of life that they can be injured, coming back from injury, rehabilitation. But it gave me a purpose and a community to move with, Luke, which I think is very important, and also helps other people get off the couch and get going, and it's good for their mental health too. So, and fast forward now another 6 months or 7 months, I'm looking to, which I think you're a little bit aware of. I want to publish a book. I want to write a book about these stories and adventures and these, these experiences, I'm going to call them. And I also, want to get back on the public speaking circuit as well, so that people can see and to help people see that, we're only limited by our thoughts, or we're only limited by our own self-belief or our own, our own thinking patterns or thought patterns. So we're quite capable animals, aren't we, if we see it in the right manner. But you've got to be able to do the hard work, and you've got to be able to keep researching like you did. And that's what I love about what you just told me. You didn't give up. And far too many people sort of say, especially with Western medication, I believe, as they just, they're big believers of what they get told, and that's all they do, and they're not prepared to push and keep going and keep looking and keep searching. And I think that's the beauty of what I get out of your story, Luke, is that you kept going. You didn't stop.
Yeah, and I'm very glad I didn't. Like, I've always been ambitious. My ambition at the beginning of my life was fueled by the expectations that I would get somewhere and some feeling someday, and I'd fix all my problems. Like, I was driven to be sort of entrepreneurial and look into finances from a young age. Not that I made loads of money then, but I would find opportunities within ways of making money. But I was driven to try and get private care for my mum, which I never achieved. But I was driven to, like, I was like, oh, I'll be able to one day maybe get her in a better position. And I was working for that. I had something that I was working towards with a cause inside. And I like what you said. Like you said, you believe it happened for a reason, because that was something that years ago would have irritated me, when I had lots of friends that would say religious or something, and they're like, oh, everything happens for a reason. And I used to always answer, no, everything happens because of a reason, not for a reason.
That's right.
And I was always, but now I where I am now in my life, like, I call myself a man of faith. I don't have any religion at all. I'm not attached to any religion, but I believe
I'm pretty much the same.
I believe we have a choice, and that's the powerful thing of being a human, is choice. And I believe we have a choice on how we perceive life. And if we perceive it one way, we get a certain reaction from it. If we perceive it another way, we get another reaction from it. And I noticed the moment I perceived that life is happening for me, not to me, and that life is serving me in all moments. And it may not give me what I want, but it will give me what I need. And I have that choice to see it that way. And through that lens, I have the choice of tuning myself to opportunity. So whatever hits me, whatever happens in my life,
It's not against you.
Yeah, it's not against me. It may seem like it's not giving me what I want, but maybe I didn't know what I needed. So whatever happened with Danielle, it was now like, what did that give me? What I see my mom as like the greatest gift in my life. Yet years ago, it was my biggest torture. It caused me so much suffering in the moment. You know,
I
was like, no, that was a gift. She gave me awareness. She gave me a look. She told me the importance of having your mind, the importance of having your conscious ability to move yourself properly, because she did behavior that she wasn't able to control mentally and physically, you know. So from a young age, that made me appreciate that. So that was a great gift, because I see people take that for granted these days. Everyone, but a majority. And it's like, it's something that I've seen from a young age.
And the biggest thing I've got out of what you said just before too is, until you learn to love yourself, you know, until you learn to love yourself, everything else is going to be whatever it is, you know. So, you know, and not finding love from outside sources. And I tell you what, you got to drill pretty deep, don't you, Luke? But once you get there, that's the key to me, to unlocking all these doors, is to give yourself a bit of time. And I've had nothing but that, you know. Things have been taken away and taken away and taken away that I would defer to. But now I've 13 months later, and your partner will certainly resonate with this, that you don't have all these things that you're used to doing, or material things that you had or have, and all those things, they get stripped away. And once you get to those bare bones, you just have no choice but to start diving into yourself. And I feel that you've been on that journey too, Luke. So, and that's the one you like to share, isn't it?
Yeah, and that's the one where, like you said, once you strip away so many things, you've only got what's left to analyze and to look at, and then look for appreciation in that. And then once you find that appreciation, gratitude with that little you have, anything other than
beautiful.
It just becomes a lot easier. Everything becomes smoother. And like you said, love. I started practicing self-love when I came to the realization that how I was, say, my inner voice wasn't of a loving nature. The way I treated my body was not, it was more like someone that was a dictator with a whip, getting me to do things, rather than someone encouraging me and supporting me and loving me to do something. And
that's right, and
that is not at all how I would coach any of the people when I was doing youths, when they were boxing clients, when I was personal training. I did not coach them in the same way I was internally coaching myself, and I realized that. And I was like, my internal coach is cruel, horrible, one of the worst coaches I've met. You know, he's got the right sort of ideas, but he's not going about it in the right way at all. I would fire him, and I did.
Your alter ego, mate. Yeah.
And I was like, you know what? I don't need to push myself. I need to encourage myself, pull myself to where it needs to go, but not push it and whip it.
Not force it. Just let it be. Yeah.
And that was
find its way.
And that was a big part. And we'll have to catch up in the future if you've got anything on the book as well, because I, as of last week, got out my first book.
Seen that. I had a look at your website and everything, obviously, before I came on. And, fantastic, mate. It's just fantastic to see what you were doing. I love it. So.
Oh, nice. Yeah, and that book came about because I started writing a book called The Power of Self, and that was all about techniques and things that have helped me in my life, that have helped Danielle, and that I've seen even through my personal training and my youth, but all techniques that sort of give you more power to self. And then during that process, I wanted to put out the first chapter as like a freebie for people just to get a little taste of it, and ended up writing a whole another book called The Self, Who Am I? And that was because I realized before you give power to something, you should have a direction, really, and have a little bit of clarity of your identity. So I done a book on getting to like a core identity of yourself, not your job or your title or all the like I believe everyone has a purpose, and I call it the three pillars purpose. And it's all about getting down to know that you have a direction, you have somewhere to go to, and a cause, and like you said, a reason for being. And if you know that, and you can then tune yourself to opportunity. Every moment that hits you, like you with your leg, you're like, right, I'm here to be of service. How does this event give me a new tool to that service?
That's right. And
Like you're using it, it sounds, with the
coach. And challenging yourself all the time. I think that's it, because it's so easy to quit. It's so easy to give up. But if you just keep peeking over the fence, and I think there's a resonation there with you too. You just keep having a look and you're just curious. You don't have to dive in. You just, I'm curious about that. I wonder if I went down this path. What if I did this instead of sitting here? And that's where I guess you see patterns in human behaviour that it just gets too much for them and they don't go there. And so they start creating layers on themselves of defeat. Because they just didn't take that one path that could have. We're all only one decision away, aren't we, Luke, from a different life? So,
yeah, I think it was another motivational speaker. He talked about like a 2 millimeter shift, and he said, I think he used a golf analogy, and he's like, the difference between the world's best golfer and the worst. He goes, it's just 2 millimeters difference when they hit. And he goes, that will make all the difference in the long distance, in the long game. He goes, one decision might just be that tiniest shift, but it might send you somewhere totally different.
Yeah, that's right. And then you sit back and look at your body of work, I suppose you could call it, and you go, wow, you know, I've been very fortunate to have all these experiences. So the time for me right now is to get that out and share that to the world or to people, as many as I can, so that they can understand that. The possibility for them to do it is just as real as mine was.
Yeah, and when you look, like I've always been interested in people that are putting out, say, encouraging content and motivational content, and some of the biggest speakers that have the largest events, they bring on people that have been through adversity to inspire others. You know, they'll bring on someone that's lost their legs. They'll bring on someone that's, you know, faced some sort of hardship. And just they're the only thing that's they're inspirational about is actually they still have a good attitude despite whatever happened to them, that they haven't let that destroy their nature of being kind and compassionate and finding joy. And it seems to be that's something that people crave and are contagious about. So it inspires them. So then, you know, and that's what your story's got for you to be like, you're talking now, you're in a good attitude, you're in a good place with what's happened. I imagine, like you said, there's been ups and downs, but that's inspiring. You know, it inspires me to hear someone that's, you know, their life's given them an obstacle and they're like, right, what's the opportunity here? How can I make service to others?
Yeah, instead of sitting in it. Yeah, I appreciate you saying that. It's very true. And, you know, because if we become stagnant, I think we're in trouble.
Yeah, and I think there is no stagnant because nothing, when we look into the world, nothing is still. You're either dying or...
No such thing.
Yeah, so it's like when someone thinks, oh, I'm stagnant, I'm waiting, I'm sitting here, like contemplating with something, it's like, well, unless you put in your ambitions into, like you say, searching for in that contemplation for the opportunity, or are you beating yourself up and you're actually shrinking yourself, your abilities, and putting yourself into a worse place?
Either way, Luke, still something happening, isn't that?
Yeah. Yeah, no, always. So how is your book process going? When do you have a completion date? Are you in the beginning stages or?
I'm in the beginning stages. I've actually got hold of a local person here that she's a professor and a lecturer, and she's done a lot of writing in the past because this is very new to me. I've never gone down that path, but I just feel it's something that I, you know, that's calling me to do. So I've got enough experiences, I think, that could shape a fairly positive and motivational tool in a book. So I'm going for it, and I'm just sort of trying to get the structure or the foundation, because if there's no structure or foundation around it, you're just journaling. And so I've got to make that shift from just writing or journaling, you know, to actually getting the content right for a book. And mate, I'd be very interested to hear what you've got to say about it, Luke, because you've written a few. So, it's like a new world again, you know. Even though I'm 53, I've had doing all these things. So here's another new thing, you know. We're going to have a crack at. So,
Well, for my writing was an interesting journey. Because I've been, like I said, YouTube content creating now for like a year and a half or so. And how I do my YouTube content is very freestyle. I set the camera up. Danielle might say to me earlier that morning, she goes, oh, what are you talking about today? I said, I don't know. I said, no idea. I said, I just press record and start talking and see what happens. And so I very often just go into it completely free. And it's just like, I'll just take a few breaths and whatever hits me in that moment. I know what my mission is and what that core sort of value is that I'm trying to bring to my content. So I was like, I know that. So whatever I speak about will always resonate to that. So I will just open my mouth and let it flow. And that's how like most of my YouTube videos are done. My podcast, I set up a structure. I knew what I wanted from the podcast, from the guests. So I wanted to, I called it the selfish podcast because I love talking to people, hearing their stories. It motivates me, excites me, you know, it gives me more momentum in life. I wanted to bring their voice to others because everyone has a story, everyone's unique. And I was like, I want to create a platform where they can share themselves and their journey and even their content. If they are also content creators, they've got a place where they can advertise, you know, if they're doing something, share it, let people know. If they're interested, they can at least then follow along. That's why I created the podcast. And after a year of talking about myself as well so much, I was like, I want to hear other people.
You want to find out what else is going on. That's brilliant.
But with the writing of the book, I went into that and I was like, right, I'm going to start with structure. And I've always been interested in storytelling. And me and my brother were getting into film writing and script writing. And that's all about, there's a lot of structure in the story of for good storytelling. There's a baseline of structure. And so when I came to do my book, I'd done the same structure. I was like, I know there's a start with structure. You know, you got the foundations, your sort of principles and your values and the worth of the book itself and what you want to bring, what you're offering others. So that was my foundation. Yeah. But then I needed my blueprint to actually start doing the architecture and start getting the pillars up, start getting the structure. So the end result is a picture, you know. And for me, the first step is engaging the audience with painting the picture of what this book is, you know. So that's my starting point always, is paint the picture so they really know what they're going to get, what they're excited for, you know. And
have the reader in mind all the time, I guess. Is that right?
Yeah, the reader in mind and making sure that they know what. So as soon as you start something, you want to know what you're in for, but in an exciting way. You're not giving them all the points and no lessons, no advice, just this is where this book and where it's going. Then the second chapter, I started with trying to connect the dots, and I called it connecting the dots to myself, in terms of I want to connect my story with the reader to this book. So them three things: what's the book, who am I and who are they, and how do these three things intertwine and connect, and talk about that, you know, and really talk about why the book's here, parts of my life and how that's brought me to this point, and why that's good for them, why I'm happy and grateful for them reading it and trying to bring in that area, you know. And then it was going through like that. I had the chapters outlined in that sort of structure of like, right, I want to start, like you said, like a movie starts with just like interesting, you know. They need to hook you in the first 15 minutes, so you want to carry on. There's no real drama normally. It might be something exciting that seems dramatic, but the actual drama and storytelling hasn't started in the same way as the lessons learned by, say, the hero, the character. That doesn't come to the second act, you know, and then there's always an obstacle. And it's like in that bit, there's the meat, there's the obstacles overcome, you know, and then you end on a feel-good vibe that's connecting with the audience. And again, always ending with the appreciation and gratitude. And for me, it's ending with the element of explaining free choice to someone. Although you've just told them a load of stuff, I'm in no way trying to force them to behave anyway. That's their choice.
Oh, mate, I reckon we could talk for hours.
Yeah.
Day.
Yeah, that's when I started the podcast, I had to build that into the structure and go, right, I need to put a time limit, because, yes, it's, you can always keep talking and get guests like you, and I can talk and talk and talk and talk. We'll definitely have to catch up in the future. We'll do something else. I have a second show that I've started, which is called Obstacles to Opportunities. And it's a
short show,
and it's going to be video only. Not video only, that'd be boring, and it's just video, no audio. Video and audio. And that's going to be like a live show, maybe. It depends, because of with guests and time zones, it's a little bit. It might, some episodes I think will be live, some will be pre-recorded, but it will be video. I'm going to keep it short of 15 to 30 minutes, where the guests will just pick an obstacle they've had and how they found an opportunity in it, to what they think opportunity is. And yes, I'd be glad to have you back in the future, and maybe you can talk.
Yeah, that'd be awesome, Luke. Yeah.
Whatever your thing is on that, but like straight away comes to mind is what you've been through and how that's been an opportunity for you to create a book, you know?
Yeah.
And put you on that path.
Keep going. Yeah.
But no, it's been amazing to talk to you and get to know your story and life and journey, and really excited to see where it goes and see this book come to life, and where I can see it going to so many places.
It's been a really worthwhile chat, and I've got a few things out of it too. I've just jotted down, so the book might come out a little bit quicker than I thought now.
Drop me a message anytime if anything else. Like I said, I've done that book. I'm still writing the longer book, which I've pretty much done. It just I need to go through, edit it, and do all that. The less fun part of grammar checking and spelling checking.
Yeah.
And do all that.
But I think sometimes it's how these books come about, and that's what I like. It's the journey to it sometimes, isn't it? So, yeah.
I can always get distracted or excited for the next thing. So I've got other books that I've already, like, I start writing just to keep while the idea's fresh, I write a little bit and have that in the background. But then I've got to concentrate on one to finish it before I start the next one, because Zank in me always like, just start writing the next one. It's like, you haven't even finished this one. Yeah,
fantastic.
But no, yeah, so that one will be coming some point this year. And I even started another one just a few weeks ago that it's going to probably be out before this longer one. But no, I'm definitely here if you need some more on structure, and we can do a cool non-recorded for the podcast if you just wanted to go through it in a bit more detail with the book writing at any point. Just let me know.
I reckon I might take you up on that. That sounds like a good idea, because look, you can never have too much information. I reckon that's one part of my journey that I know you can. There's no such thing as too much learning. So
no, yeah, and for me it was also, I got the podcast. So I interviewed people that are publishers, authors, self-published, to hear their story. You know, that was an opportunity for me to go, okay, they're doing something where I'm going. So I learned and got a lot of things through different avenues in that.
Yeah, wowzers. Yeah, that's awesome, mate.
But no, for the end of the show, I ask all my guests that set off the same fun, just lighthearted questions that sort of one.
Yeah, sure.
You have time for them?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, I've probably got 5 minutes. So.
Well, perfect. Yeah, so if you had to choose one, cat or a dog?
Dog.
Mm. What's your favourite colour?
Favourite colour is blue. Either blue or green.
Okay.
Depending on mood.
And if you was to put it in a simple form, what motivates you? What excites you?
Look, what motivates and excites me is just peeking over the fence. So just always curious to have a look at whatever. It doesn't have to be a specific thing, you know, like just
curiosity.
Yeah, just that curiosity, and I've always enjoyed a challenge. So if anyone puts a challenge out there, I'm often the first one to accept. So those are little things that are motivators, and they're probably it. Yeah.
Nice. And what sound or noise do you love?
Oh wow. You know what I really love? I love the beating of the drums, and that really does it for me. And because when I was a child, we lived near a railway station, so I loved the sound of the trains.
Oh, nice! It's funny, because if you was an adult and you live near a railway station, they would say they don't like the sound of trains. But
that's right. I don't know if I'd like to live that close. What the picture I just painted then, but Yeah, just the food of the train, and you can just hear it in the background. Yeah. Oh, nice. It doesn't bore me, yeah.
And what sound or noise do you not love so much?
It's always the same old one, isn't it? It's the chalk on the blackboard for me, or the fingernails. You know.
Yeah. What do you love about yourself?
I love that I'm always willing to have a crack. Yeah, yeah. I'm always up to have a go. You know, I'm never one to sit back and wish it away, I guess. So I really do enjoy that about myself, yeah.
Nice. And what do you love to see in other people?
I love the same sort of energy. I love that type of personality. People that are just, it doesn't matter what it is, and it doesn't matter, it's willing to have a go, you know. I guess you could call it in other terms as stepping into their fears. So I like people that are willing to take on a challenge, or they're willing to have a go at something that they probably believe that they couldn't do, but they are more than capable if we can get them to do it. So I love that. I love that scenario in people.
Mm. Nice. And last question, what do you love about animals? This could be animals in nature or pets, whatever your choice.
Yeah, look, I'm an animal lover, actually. I live across the road from what we call the Ballarat Wildlife Park, and I'm literally 100 metres from it, and it's they've got all these diverse, you know, they've got the kangaroos and wallabies and koalas and crocodiles and reptiles, and I've always been a bit of a nature boy, I guess, so I've always loved nature, and I've always loved animals. It's just something that I've grown up with, and I think animals have got this really cool intuition, Luke. They can sense stuff straight away. You know, if you're in strife, or you're a good person, or you've done some pretty cruddy stuff, they have the intuition that we could only wish for, I reckon.
Yeah, nice. All right, Mick, well, it's been beautiful to get to know you in more detail. I really enjoyed having a conversation with you, and thank you so much for being open and honest and authentic and just sharing with me and the audience.
No, you're welcome, Luke. It's been a pleasure, and hope we get to catch up again.
Yep, for sure we will. I think you said it's evening time for you, actually, so I'll be saying goodnight, isn't it? Normally for most of my guests, it's early in the morning because a lot of them are in the States. Yeah. So I'm always saying have a good rest of your day. With you, it's nighttime, so yeah. Have a nice rest, a nice sleep, and appreciate you being on here, and yeah, all the best.
Will do. And I hope those sheep don't come and invade you.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of The Selfish Podcast. Don't forget to like, comment, share, and leave a review if you can. It really helps other people find the content. And if you gain something from this, maybe someone else will too. I truly appreciate you being here. I'm grateful for every single one of you. You inspire me to continue to create content on YouTube, podcasts, and as many platforms as I can online. So thank you so much. Big thank you to my patrons out there. If it wasn't for you, I wouldn't be online. If you'd like to become a patron, go to patreon.com/LukeGreenheart. All the links will be in the description. And don't forget, you can get my free copy of my book, The Self, Who Am I? Which gives clarity to identity and direction to your purpose through beautiful insights and perception. So go check that out. You can get it free at lukegreenheart.com/free. Remember, links in the description. It's also available as a paperback on Amazon. Have a beautiful day. I truly appreciate you. Love life. Love yourself. Love others. Thank you again for being here.